Well, our series is Wine and the Bible, and I have taken the position to defend the view that the Bible condemns all use of fermented wine and fully approves the use of unfermented wine. I have concluded that both fermented and unfermented grape juice are called wine, and both fermented and unfermented fruit juice are called shekor in the Hebrew Old Testament. I have concluded that tirosh does not mean wine, but it means fruit. And in the last message, I sought to give you a picture of Israel in Bible times and the importance of the vintage, and proposed that in the vintage season they produced thousands upon thousands of gallons of grape juice. Since I have come to the conclusion that alcoholic wine is forbidden by the Word of God, I also have to concede that in order for that to be true, there must have been ways to preserve this juice without allowing fermentation to take place. I will take the bulk of this message from William Patton's book that is available in our library, or will soon be available in the library. It's called Bible Wines, or The Laws of Fermentation. And this book was published almost 200 years ago. And this man writes, "My interest in the cause of temperance," that's refraining from alcoholic beverages, "my interest in the cause of temperance was awakened by the evidence which crowded upon me as a pastor in the city of New York of the aboundings of intemperance. The use of drinks was then universal. Liquor was sold by the glass at almost every corner. It stood on every sideboard and was urged upon every visitor. It was spread upon every table and abounded at all social gatherings. It found a conspicuous place at nearly every funeral. It ruled in every workshop. Many merchants kept it in their counting rooms and offered it to their customers who came from the interior to purchase goods. Men in all the learned professions, as well as merchants, mechanics, and laborers, fell by this destroyer." Now, I didn't give any record of this yet, but later on, about 100 years later, the United States of America passed a law that allowed no liquor at all. They smashed huge casks of liquor, and the liquor flowed down the gutter and was drained away. And for 15 years in the United States of America, they were not allowed to drink any liquor at all. Out of that came wealthy, wealthy bootleggers, people who sold liquor illegally. And then liquor was legalized again in the United States. But before that is this event. He says in his book here, "I soon found that the concession so generally made, even by ministers, that the Bible sanctions the use of intoxicating drinks was the most impregnable citadel into which all drinkers, all apologists for drinking, and all vendors of the article fled. This compelled me thus early to study the Bible patiently and carefully to know its exact teachings." And I suppose that his book was born from these studies, Bible Wines or the Laws of Fermentation. Today, we are fast approaching another time when liquor is a common substance even in Christian homes. And it is growing fast today in America. Some have concluded that grape juice could not be kept long before it fermented. The natural conclusion then is that in the Bible, wine must refer to fermented drink because they could not keep grape juice very long before it fermented. The New Bible Dictionary on page 1254 says this: "The term new wine does not indicate wine which has not fermented, for in fact, the process of fermentation sets in very rapidly, and unfermented wine could not be available many months after the harvest. There's the conclusion of modern day scholars. I believe that is a Scanlon error. It is an unresearched error, and it seems to me that the reason greater research was not done is because the writers are convinced in the Bible wine is fermented. There's no use researching it. It's so obvious. It is an open and shut case, but that is not so, as we will see in this point of our message. So having seen in our last message the need for preservation because of the abundance of wine produced in the Bible times, we now want to look at point B, the methods of preserving wine. Now, as I thought over this message this morning, I thought this is the most unbiblical message I've ever done. It's not unbiblical in the sense that it's against the Bible. It's unbiblical in the sense that you can't find this information in the Bible. And since we are on our summer terms, I can take a few moments to explain something. There are two kinds of revelation, of truth. One is called general revelation. One is called special revelation. General revelation teaches us facts through science and history and so on. Special revelation teaches us facts from the Word of God which cannot be gleaned from science. You cannot learn from science that Jesus is the Christ. We learn that from special revelation, the Word of God. But you can learn the laws of fermentation from science. That's why the Bible doesn't deal with it. And so this morning, the message will be based on general revelation, not special revelation so much. So as we begin our consideration of methods of preserving juices without fermentation, let us begin by asking these questions. What are the scientific laws that govern fermentation? And number two, can fermentation be avoided so as to preserve grape juice or any other fruit juice in its sweet condition? So we look at these scientific laws. Patton says, Professor Donovan, in his work on domestic economy, mentioned three methods by which all fermentation could be prevented. One, grape juice will not ferment when the air is completely excluded. You exclude all air, no fermentation. Number two, by boiling down the juice, or in other words, evaporating the water, the substance becomes a syrup which, if very thick, will not ferment. Number three, if the juice be filtered and deprived of its gluten or ferment, the production of alcohol will be impossible. He quotes Antibacus, page 162. Patton then goes on to say, Dr. The eminent chemist, says that fermentation may be tempered or stopped, number one, by those means which render the yeast inoperative, particularly by the oils that contain sulfur, or oil of mustard, as also by the sulfurous and sulfuric acids. Number two, by the separation of the yeast, either by the filter or subsidence. Number three, by lowering the temperature to 45 degrees, if the fermentation mass becomes clear at this temperature and be drawn off from the subsided yeast, it will not ferment again, though it should be heated to the proper pitch. Antibacus, page 225. Patton then says, Baron Liebig, in his Letters on Chemistry, says, if a flask be filled with grape juice and made airtight and then kept a few hours in boiling water, the wine does not ferment. Now notice that he calls the grape juice wine. That's true in the Bible as well, unfermented grape juice. Bible Commentary, volume 37. Patton then concludes like this, the unalterable laws of nature, which are the laws of God, teach these stern facts. Number one, that very sweet juices and thick syrups will not undergo the vinous fermentation. By the way, you know what? You put enough sugar into grape juice and it won't ferment. When the sugar overtakes the yeast, it won't ferment. Do you know when they make wine, the yeast is on the outside of the skin, and the sweetness is on the inside. And when you mix the outside and the inside, that's when fermentation takes place. Only when you mix the two together. Number two, that the direct and inevitable fermentation of the sweet juices in hot climates with the temperature above 75 degrees will be acetuous. That is, it doesn't ferment, it becomes sour. Number three, that to secure the vinous fermentation, the temperature must be... Now listen, in order for things to ferment, this is what has to be... This is what the conditions have to be. The temperature must be between 50 and 75 degrees. If it's higher or lower, it won't ferment. And that the exact proportions of sugar, gluten, and water must be secured. Number four, that all fermentation may be prevented by excluding the air, by boiling, by filtration, by subsidence, and by the use of sulfur. Now that's science. Fermentation may be stopped. So let's consider these methods of preservation. But before we look at the methods, let me say something here first that I think is often misunderstood. It is common to think that by letting juices ferment, they are thereby preserved. That fermentation is a method of preserving juice. But as I understand it, fermentation is not a means of preserving grape juice. It is the slow process of decay or spoilage. It's the spoilage of the juice. My wife and I visited a winery this summer to see firsthand what goes on in the vineyard. The wines produced in that vineyard, this is not true of all of them, were good for only from 2 to 3 years after that they spoil. Wine does not stay good forever. Wine to be kept for ages has to be treated right before that can happen, because wine, as soon as it ferments, is spoiling and is on the way out, and you just leave it a few years and it's spoiled entirely. So it is not a means of preservation, it is the process of spoiling. So there is much evidence, not only from Patton's research, but from the quotes he gives, that in Bible times, they had ways and means of preserving wine without fermentation. By the way, this is an unbiblical message, and it's not drawn from the Bible. But the truths that I'm going to give you in this message are those that will do away with this Scanlon error. The thinking is that when you read the Bible, in Bible time they couldn't keep grape juice long. They had it all year long, so it must be fermented. And that is an error. I want to mention something else to you as well. Not only did they have ways of preserving juices, but they had ways of preserving the fruit itself. This was a new discovery to me, and as I discussed it this summer with my wife's family, we were discussing this, and one of them, a trucker, said that he had spoken with a truck driver who hauled lime to fruit growers. Any truck drivers here are familiar with anybody hauling lime to fruit growers? Not in Alberta, right? Southern BC, big fruit country. The fruit growers would put their fruits that they would store for some months into an airtight building. The nice fresh fruit was put into the building, and then they would haul lime into the building. Then they would close the doors and seal them, and you could just leave it for months, and then when you open the doors, you have fruit just as fresh as when you close them. He said, this is how you get fresh fruit all year long without it being in season. So even today there are methods of doing this. As I was studying all this, I came across a quote by Patton from Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote shortly after the time of Christ. He records the fall of Masada. Let me ask, how many are familiar with Masada? Masada. Okay. One familiar with Masada. I have visited Masada. Masada is in Israel. It's beside the Dead Sea. And when I was at Masada, I took the following information from a booklet that I was given when I was there at Masada. You see, Masada is a rock outcropping that goes up like this on all sides, and on top there is a flat top. And here they build fortresses to be able to hold up for years if they needed to from their enemies. And if you go to Israel today, you can take a tram up to Masada, to the top of Masada. They used to climb it on the sides, and we climbed it when I was there as well, but it's very steep and very high. So about 100 years before Christ, Masada, which is a high rocky mountain with a flat top close beside the Dead Sea, was fortified by the Maccabean king Alexander Janias. Then 40 years before Christ, the Herod mentioned at Christ's birth built a royal sanctuary way up on top of Masada, and he stored all kinds of food there and made cisterns to collect water so that he would be able to live there for years if need be. Now, we climbed up the side of Masada and looked into the cisterns carved out of rock on Masada. Now, it's a dry country, but they could hold water there, and just depending on the few rains that they caught, could get, they would be able to live there for years. 66 years after the birth of Christ, some Jewish zealots overpowered the Roman garrison stationed at Masada and took over this fortress. For 7 years, they held this formidable rocky mountain. 7 years. No food brought up, no water brought up, no ever coming down. 7 years up on top of this hill. So Rome invented a way to take over. And when the Jews, almost 1,000 of them, 900 and some, who were in the fortress, saw that Rome would take them, they made an agreement, and they all took their own lives. 900 and some people all died in 1 hour up on this hill. Rather than be enslaved to Rome, they all died in one day at their own hands. And from that event now comes the famous saying in Israel, and if you will go to Israel, you will hear this. If you go to Masada, Masada shall never fall again. Masada will never fall again. Masada fell once. 900 and some Jews lost their lives. It will never fall again. Now listen to Josephus. He's writing, it's almost 2,000 years ago. He's writing an account of their food storage. Here's what he writes. This is written 2,000 years ago. As for the stores laid up within this fortress, it was still more wonderful on account of its splendor and long continuance. For here was laid up grain in large quantities, and such as would subsist men for a long time. Here was also wine and oil in abundance, with all kinds of vegetables and dates heaped up together. All which Eleazar found there when he and his Sicarii got possession of the fortress by treachery. These fruits were also fresh and fully ripe, and no way inferior to such fruits recently harvested, although they were little short of 100 years. Little short of 100 years. From the storage of these provisions by Herod, till the place was taken by the Romans. Nay, indeed, when the Romans got possession of these fruits that were left, they found them not rotted at all that while. Nor should we be mistaken if we suppose that the air was here the cause of their enduring so long. This fortress being so high and so free from the mixture of all earth-born and muddy particles of matter. Now, that may be exaggerated. Last week, I gave you a story that I felt was a little exaggerated. Do you remember that? I talked about the grapevines that were like this. I was telling this, my son-in-law said, hey, we were down on the eastern coast of the United States and we took pictures of grapevines almost as big as you described. And this morning, when you go out on the left-hand side, I was going to put them on overhead, my computer gave up, there are pictures of vines almost as big as the ones I described. But let us say that Josephus is wrong by 90 years. That would mean for 10 years or almost 10 years they could still keep grapes as fresh as they were the day that they were picked. Now even that seems hard to believe. Let's say he was wrong by 99 years, right? You could keep him for 1 year. That means you could have fresh grapes all year long and you could make fresh wine all year long. Patton says that William Quiston, the translator of Josephus, says this in a footnote to Josephus' account. This is what he says. Pliny and others confirm this strange paradox that provisions thus laid up against sieges will continue good 100 years. As Spanheim notes upon this place. So I went to Josephus to check to see what Josephus said. He said exactly this. And then I checked the footnote, and the footnote said exactly that. Then Patton says, Swinburne says that in Spain, they also have the secret of preserving grapes sound and juicy from one season to another. Bible Commentary, page 278. Again, he writes, Mr. E.C. Delavan states that when he was in Florence, this is about 200 years ago, Italy, Florence, Italy, Signor Pepini, one of the largest wine manufacturers, told him that he had then in his lofts for the use of his table until the next vintage, the next time grapes were ripe, a quantity of grapes sufficient to make 100 gallons of wine, that grapes could always be had at any time of the year to make any desirable quantity, and that there was nothing in the way of obtaining the fruit of the vine free from fermentation in wine countries for any period. A large basket of grapes was sent to my lodgings, which were as delicious and looked as fresh as if recently taken from the vines, though they had been picked for months. Bible Commentary, page 278. Then Patton adds, Reverend Dr. H. Duff, in his travels through the south of Europe, most fully confirms this. If in Jesus' day, and before they had methods of storing fruit in a fresh way for a long time, if in Jesus' day they could store fruits for a long time fresh, should it be surprising to us that they could have grape juice which was not fermented all year long? Should it be surprising? So that there were methods of keeping fruit and fruit juices for considerable length of time is too clear to deny. So we must not fall into the error that unfermented wine was not available many months after the vintage. Well, listen, when we come to communion wine, I'm going to tell you that it was unfermented. I believe I'm going to prove to you it was unfermented. And that was 6 months after the harvest. So having said all that, let me give you several chosen quotes from Patton on each of the methods of preserving wine in an unfermented state. First, by boiling water or letting the water from the juice evaporate. So I'm going to give you a number of quotes now. Quote number one, by boiling the juice, the richest grape loses all its aptitude for fermentation and may afterwards be preserved for years without undergoing any further change. You can't do that with fermented juice. Fermented grape juice undergoes change as long as you have it. It's always changing. That's why they age wine, because it's always changing. At a certain age, it reaches its peak. Quote number two, the property of organic substance to pass into a state of decay is annihilated in all cases by heating to the boiling point. The grape juice boils at 212 degrees, but alcohol evaporates at 170 degrees, which is 42 degrees below the boiling point. So then, if any possible portion of alcohol was in the juice, this process would expel it. The obvious object of boiling the juice was to preserve it sweet and fit for use during the year. Page 20, quote number three. The juice or liquor pressed out of the ripe grapes is called vinum, wine. Of it is made both sapa and the frutum, in English cute, that is to say boiled wine. The latter boiled down to the half, the former boiled down to the third. Quote number 4. In Italy and Greece, it was common to boil their wines. That means they're unfermented. There was another method they called filtration. By the way, you can look at Encyclopedia Britannica or any other reliable source that covers stuff like this. They give you the same information. Quote number 5. Filtration. Now, by filtration, the gluten or yeast is separated from the juice. They would pour it through a cloth, very tight cloth, and thus filter the wine. And so by filtration, the gluten or yeast is separated from the juice of the grape. Whilst the juice will pass through the filtering implements, the gluten will not, and being thus separated, the necessary conditions for fermentation are destroyed. Quote number 6. Listen to this quote taken by Patton from Pliny, the one I quoted earlier. The most useful wine has all its force or strength broken by the filter. We're talking writers many, many hundreds of years ago. The most useful wine, the best wine, is unfermented, according to this man. He had no care about whether it was right or wrong. The most useful wine has all its force or strength broken by the filter, page 25. Then Patton says this, others hold that the true rendering is, for all the sick, the wine is most useful when its forces have been broken by the strainer. Drink a little wine for your stomach's sake. Quote number 7, Captain Treat in 1845 wrote, when on the south coast of Italy last Christmas, I inquired particularly about the wines in common use and found that those esteemed the best were sweet and unintoxicating. The boiled juice of the grape is in common use in Sicily. That means it's unfermented. The Calabrians keep their intoxicating and unintoxicating wines in separate apartments. The bottles were generally marked. From inquiries, I found that the unfermented wines were esteemed the most. It was drunk mixed with water. The Bible talks about mixed wines as we're talking about some of these things. Great pains were taken in the vintage season to have a good stock of it laid by. The grape juice was filtered 2 or 3 times, then boiled, and some put in casks and buried in the earth, some kept in water. This means several different methods of keeping it from fermenting on one kind of juice. Page 26. Let us consider another method called subsidence. In this method, the juice is kept at a temperature below 45 degrees. The gluten settles to the bottom, and the juice which is separated from the gluten like this will not ferment. Quote number 8. Pliny, when speaking of wine called iglucas, that is always sweet, which means unfermented, says that wine is produced by care. He then gives the method. They plunge the casks immediately after they are filled from the vat into water until water has passed away. Water has passed away and the wine has acquired the habit of being cold. Being kept below 45 degrees, the gluten settled to the bottom and thus fermentation was prevented. Page 27, quote number 9. Columella gives the recipe, gather the grapes and expose them for 3 days to the sun. On the 4th, at midday, tread them. Take the mustum liximum, that is the juice which flows into the lake before you use the press, and when it has settled, add 1 ounce of powdered iris, strain the wine from its faces, and put it into a vessel. This wine will be sweet, firm or durable, and healthy to the body. Isn't that interesting what you can learn from these people? Well, Patton gives a number of other recipes, but let us consider yet another method called fumigation. Quote number 10. Dr. States that fermentation may be stopped by the application of admixture of substances containing sulfur, that the operation consists partly in absorbing oxygen, whereby the elimination of the yeastly particles is prevented. Adams, in his Roman Antiquities, on the authority of Pliny and others, says that the Romans fumigated their wines with the fumes of sulfur. That means they wouldn't ferment. That's how they had their wine, at least a lot of it. That they also mixed with the mustum, newly pressed juice, yolk of eggs, and other articles containing sulfur. When thus it was refined, it was poured into smaller vessels or casks and covered over with pitch and bunged or stopped up. That's to keep the oxygen out of it. Page 29. Quote number 11. Miller's Gardener's Dictionary, article wine, says, "The way to preserve new wine in the state of must is to put it up in very strong but small casks, firmly closed on all sides, by which it means it will be kept from fermenting. But if it should happen to fall into fermentation, the only way to stop it is by fumes of sulfur." So if they put the fumes of sulfur over the casks, they would not further ferment. And so, in conclusion, we have considered the basic laws of fermentation and a number of ways in which unfermented grape juice could be preserved. We thus have a rather significant amount of information that confirms that both in Jesus' day and earlier and later, the ancients had ways of keeping wines unfermented, and that it was considered a precious commodity, unfermented. Those who hold that grape juice could not be kept long without fermentation certainly do not have historical evidence on their side. We should also learn from today's information, or the information given this morning, how important sweet, unfermented drinks were in Bible times. Would they have gone through all this trouble finding out all these methods of keeping it sweet if it hadn't been valuable? Not considerable. To think that all grape juice was soon turned into intoxicating drink is certainly a scanon error. I read this quote from Dr. David Hawking. Now here is a man of thorough research in almost everything he does. Yes, he said this in a message on wine. "Christians sometimes try to snow people on their views about wine. I have watched," he was in Israel, he said, "I have watched in 24 hours fermentation take place. So if you want me to say that there is no fermentation for months, find yourself another boy." Find yourself another boy. I can hardly believe David Hawking wouldn't have researched further to find out this information and thus commit a scandal error, and yet he believes that a believer should not have one drop of fermented drink. For anyone who is interested in studying this further, I will be making available to you in the church library the book by Patton, from which I have quoted so much this morning. I could give you a lot of other quotes of verification, but would rather make them available to you. The book is called Bible Wines, or The Laws of Fermentation. It may already be in. If not, it will be very soon, by William Patton. And if you would like to order your own copy, if you have a pen handy, I will give you the email address. You can order your own copy to this book. It is www.bethelbaptist.ca. www.bethelbaptist.ca, or email info@bethelbaptist.ca. Or you may write Bethel Baptist, and I'll just leave that for you. When the book is here, it has all this information, the email address and their address. You can write in and you can order your own information. What is the conclusion? In Bible times, in Jesus' day, they could keep wine unfermented for any length of time. And in Bible times, in Jesus' time, sweet drink, not fermented. Now they drank fermented drink, there's no doubt. But sweet drink was considered a very precious commodity. Well, may the Lord bless those words to us. Thank you.